From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. You'll know both my guests, Robin Sachs and Wendy Murphy, as DAs, as victim advocates, as authors, and tonight we're going to sit down and talk about, some boring guy that died in the news here in the last few days. Hi, Wendy. Hi, Robin. How are you?
Hi, Dana. Hi, good to be with you.
Now, I'm going to date myself. I remember exactly where I was the day Elvis died in 1977. I was working at a gas station and pumping gas, and someone said, Elvis died, and I said, that's nice. I can remember as a kid being on holidays with my family, and we actually were in Rome, and my father said to the guy at the hotel desk, and he said, what's going on? He said, why is everybody so upset? Why is everybody so depressed? Well, the Pope died that day. So we arrived in Rome the day the Pope died. And that goes back a long ways, too. But never have I seen anything as crazy, Wendy Murphy, as this whole Michael Jackson thing. And we're going to get right into that. Your thoughts on the King of Pop dying?
Wow. You know, I don't know where to begin, because the last television commentary I gave about Jackson, I was saying something like, boy, I got a new nickname for the King of Pop. Let's start calling him the Teflon Molester. and you know, I meant it, because there was a boatload of evidence against the guy, something like five different kids had been hurt by him. And, you know, the point is, I just really had the worst of the worst feelings about the guy at that time. On the other hand, I probably fall in line with virtually everyone else who just can't sit still when his music comes on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'll always feel that way about him. And, you know, I even when I was calling him the Teflon Molester, I was feeling, you know, a lot of sadness for the guy, because I really believed, and I still believe, that he had a horrible childhood, was treated like an object, used as a bank account by especially his father. You know, I don't know how you ever feel loved, much less love yourself, when people treat you like that. And I think he was so full of self-loathing. That's one of the reasons he tried so hard to make himself look like something other than the adorable black little boy he was when I first met him, so to speak, on television. And you know, the rejection of his real self, and the way that he tried to make it all go away, and then he became thinner and thinner, not even you know, liking himself enough to feed his body and keep it healthy. I mean, I've told people that I sort of watched him commit what I think was a long-term form of suicide. And that just includes everything that we've all been reading about lately, the drug abuse in particular, and taking such significant amounts, at least apparently at this point, that's what it looks like, and his body was so emaciated. I think he had just about given up believing that he was worth living. And, you know, people have said, well, who around him didn't step up to the plate and help him? You know, I think that's right. Not enough people cared about him. They cared about his money.
Yeah.
And at some point, I think Michael Jackson just stopped caring that the people around him stopped caring. And, you know, maybe he felt that he had reached the end of his ability to put up with what was really a very, very sad life. I'll just say this one thing, though. You know, I was an NFL cheerleader. I joke about why, as a and no one believes me when I say it was a social experiment. But I was an NFL cheerleader around the time of Thriller, and the Sullivans, the owners of the New England Patriots, that was the team I cheered for, sponsored his tour at the time. They actually lost a ton of money on the tour, which makes no sense, because he was so popular at the time. I think they just overpaid for it. But I remember that there was a lot of excitement, and our choreographer, in part because he was popular, but in part also because the Sullivans were sponsoring the tour, made virtually all of our dance numbers that season. I think it was 83, made all of our dance numbers somehow connect to one song or the other on Thriller. So to this day, I'm like a Pavlov's dog. When Thriller comes on, or there were so many on that album, but I just, you know, my body can't sit still. So those are some of my memories, and the storytelling around his life, I think, is the most interesting to me. Who knew him? Who claimed to know him? Who's taking advantage of the situation? Who are the real people that care deeply about him and are telling some of the more interesting stories about how they tried to save him with interventions and so forth? And,
yeah.
And that he wanted nothing to do with that, which I think is the saddest of all.
You know, Robin Sachs, ADA out of Los Angeles County, when you see these sorts of stories, I call them the enabler stories. You look at Anna Nicole Smith, you look at Elvis Presley, obviously, and you look at the parallels among them. All of a sudden, you get a Michael Jackson, and I laughed out loud at Wendy's comment about the Teflon molester. But when we saw him at that time, 93, 94, whenever it was, and then most recently, there wasn't a lot of good things being said about Michael Jackson. Then all of a sudden now he's being put up on a pedestal and compared by some in the media to the death of Princess Diana, which I find bizarre.
Well, yeah, it's interesting, Dana. You and I spoke about this right when, you know, the news of his death happened last week, and saying that, you know, it's a phenomenon to see, and in many ways a very kind of phenomenon and a great phenomenon that people can look to the best parts and best qualities of somebody and be able to separate that out from what may have been a very marred history. In my mind, and I know for speaking for you as well a little bit, if you may indulge me just a moment, is that we living in the world of law enforcement, we living in the world of crime, we living in the world of sexual assault victims have a very hard time forgetting. Separating may be one thing, and I agree with Wendy and echo her comments and everything that she said. I mean, I was the one who would run on the treadmill listening to Beat It, but that was, you know, while I'd watch, you know, court TV on the bed with him in the middle of the trial, feeling a little bit guilty for indulging myself in his music.
Jeez.
And I think that that's really, it highlights the biggest problem with sexual assault out there is that there are wonderful, talented, amazing people out there who could also have this part of their personality and this real defect to them. And it doesn't feel politically correct to talk about it at this time, about those portions, because he hasn't been laid to rest and so forth. But I look at it as, you know, as tortured in the past and history that he had and the sadness around his death, I also think about how many potential victims are not now going to be victimized.
Right, you know, and again, I laugh out loud again, listening to Beat It as you run on a treadmill watching court TV. And I'm not making light of this, of the death, because there is a tragedy, Wendy Murphy, here, and a big one, and we can take this story 15 different ways. I mentioned enabling before. We're seeing a lot of talking heads now on television and listening to them on shows like mine talking about criminal charges in a case like this, and some will say, "Ah, that's crazy," but is it?
Well, I don't think it is crazy, not at all. It's not shocking to hear that medical professionals who were either wannabes or just irresponsible or getting paid extra to hand the guy dope he shouldn't have had might be in the mix of people who are going to get in trouble. You know, we regulate controlled substances for a reason, and there is no exception under the law that I'm aware of that says, okay, as long as you're going to give it to a celebrity and they're going to pay you extra, you can just dole it out like candy. So, you know, if we're going to have regulations that say certain substances are controlled, then someone should enforce them. And sometimes we don't find out that these types of drug crimes are happening because it's all behind closed doors. It's all hush-hush. Everybody has a reason to keep it quiet until there's a tragedy. And, you know, sad, but true that Anna Nicole Smith is one example. This is going to be another one, but it certainly matters how we handle this. If we can prove, if it can be proved that doctors or any kind of medical professionals were, or even lay people were giving him drugs that were adding to his health risks and ultimately putting him at risk of death, they should be prosecuted. They should be punished harshly because you can't catch these kinds of people easily, and so you have to send a strong message when you do, especially when the whole world is paying attention. You know, that's when the punishment you dole out really does deter other people's bad behavior, because they go, oh, geez, I don't want to go to prison for the rest of my life for murder. Oh, my God, I better stop doing what I'm doing. Now, I know that's a little bit Pollyanna, but it does work somewhat, and, you know, everyone's going to be watching to say, to see whether someone in a position to send a message tells us, you know, he didn't have to die. Maybe he did. Maybe he was at risk in other ways. And we'll learn that more when the toxicology and the autopsy comes out. Maybe he was so thin and so tired and so sick and just had been through so much, his body was just at its end. And any little bit of drug was going to put him over the edge. I don't know. The only thing I can say is, and going back to your point about how people are taking advantage in a way that it's a little bit politically incorrect, but I guess we can't help it because he was, in a sense, a freak show. And for people who don't like admitting that, you know, we all paid extra attention rubbernecking our way through his life because there were things he did that were freaky, even if you loved his music, even if you thought he was fantastic and brilliant, and he certainly was. You know, the chimp and the hyperbaric chamber and, mm-hmm. you know, the ghoulish way he contorted his face and his color and all this stuff that made us think he was a bit of a freak. And so, you know, there is a comic, dark comic edge to some of the coverage. And even I, you know, I've written two pieces, one for the Daily Beast that was a very sober legal analysis of who in the circle of potential quote-unquote mothers might ultimately get permanent custody of the kids. And the most recent one in response to news today that Debbie Rowe has filed for custody. And don't even get me going on that. You think somebody's a criminal here, it should be Debbie Rowe. But let me not go there yet. But I had entitled my piece, but the kid is not my son. And I can tell you that I know that there are people who are writing columns and news stories and opinion pieces and reflection pieces who are just pouring through his music, looking for lyrics they can use to characterize a view, one view or another, about how they felt or some story they have to tell. And his lyrics are chock full of opportunities for a little bit of dark humor. So I think you're right about that.
Robin Sachs and Wendy Murphy are here. Robin, in my desk drawer, just right beside me, I have a letter from Lynn Wood, attorney for Howard K. Stern, who was very angry with me when I brought Rita Cosby on the show to talk about Anna Nicole Smith, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I want you to put your defense lawyer hat on a little bit, or your attorney hat, and the attorneys for Michael Jackson, and probably many, many out there, many true ones and many who claim to be, are going to be watching, or are they, as closely as Lynn Wood did for Howard K. Stern, for guys like me and others who may defame or say something nasty about their client?
Well, I, the one thing that I definitely know that the lawyers are out there doing at this moment is looking to see the legal analysts who are commentating on the case and looking at the positions at what they think in terms of who will be the person who will ultimately handle the will and trust in this case. And I know this firsthand. My husband's an estate lawyer in Los Angeles, and he's been involved in the inner circle of the referrals and the people involved in this case. And what I do know for a fact from him is that they are watching to see, you know, who is going to have his best interests, or what would be Michael Jackson's best interest, in order to determine who is going to be able to represent the estate and also represent Catherine in the custody battles. And so what ends up happening by default in that situation is the lawyers that know that that is the case may be curbing what they want to say, or curbing their opinions, or placating their opinions in order to hope for a potential piece of what people think will be a lifetime gravy train in terms of handling his estate.
Doesn't that take away?
Let me just throw one other response in there, Dana, because for First Amendment junkies and people like us who are yakking all the time, often with fierce opinions and offensive opinions about all sorts of things, and we take it, by the way, you know, people say similarly offensive things right back at me, and I respect their right to do that. But the interesting and the good thing, if you want to speak freely about Michael Jackson, is you can't defame a dead guy.
Right.
Yeah, okay. No, fair enough. I agree with that. But I was going to ask you, Wendy, and I think Robin makes a good point, is the attorney, the talking head, the correspondent, whatever you want to call them, he or she, that does sit back a little bit to try and work nice with the Jackson camp because it may mean money for them later down the road, does that not take away from the whole truth, justice, and the American way when it comes to the press?
Yeah, but, you know, there'll only be so many of those, and then there'll be a bunch of people like me. I mean, I am so fiercely not on anybody's payroll. I've been offered all kinds of jobs and positions, and they come with so many strings that I've very often said no, because I don't want anyone telling me what to say. And there are plenty of people like me out there who are willing to speak up, in part because of the types of activism we do. I mean, I'm an activist for children and for women's rights and for victims' rights. So I'm always going to tell the truth, no matter who's dangling anything in front of me. And I think there are enough people out there that whoever else is trying to pitch for a job, you know, the Jackson family can find them and hire them if they want to. But there are some people who are not for sale. And, you know, I'm one. I think plenty of other people out there would say the same thing. They're not looking for a job. They're looking to tell the truth. I mean, I'm very concerned. Look, as much as I was disgusted by Michael Jackson's behavior with children, I'm deeply concerned that the children are now going to be exploited by people who think even less of them, you know, than the other people around them may have in the past years when Michael was alive. In other words, Michael was probably a very good dad who made sure they weren't exploited. It seems to me he was a pretty good dad in that sense. But now what's going to happen? What if all the people around the kids, including all the ones who may well win custody, what if they're all just greedy? Mm-hmm. And they don't care about their children, and they see the children as the future gravy train. Where's the Judge Solomon and all, you know, the King Solomon / Judge Solomon and all of this, who's going to say, I pick you because you're the only one who isn't greedy? I actually have written a piece where I said, if I were the judge here, I would make everyone who thinks they care about these children stand up in court, and I would say, which one of you hereby will agree in writing to take no money to care for these children? And that's the person I would let raise the kids.
Yeah, that's a great point. Wendy Murphy and Robin Sachs are here, and we're talking Michael Jackson. Robin, you're up next until the break, and then we'll come back and talk more about this. But I want to ask you, Robin, when you look at this and you look at all the reports, our friend Harvey Levin on TMZ did a good job breaking the story, but now when you look at TMZ, you're seeing Debbie Rowe isn't the natural mother, or is she the natural? And now all of a sudden it spins 115 different directions, where it almost is to the point where some will say, well, they're just making it up because they want to keep this gravy train moving. As a broadcaster with your Justice Interrupted program, do you think that's fair? Do you think that the people really want to know? I think they do. I think this story is going to go on for a long, long time.
It's interesting. I was actually just watching CNN, who was doing a report on this exact issue, and it's a debate I think that happens all the time. And when we had Jane Velez Mitchell on our show a couple of weeks ago, she brought up the same point about talking about the cases that actually make their way to the media and the cases that don't. And as you know, on Justice Interrupted, it's our goal on that show to talk about all the millions and hundreds of cases that happen every day in cities, counties throughout the country where the media does not pick up the story, but they need a little bit of media attention perhaps to make sure that the right result happens. And that's exactly, not only do I do that, Wendy does that in her activism and her role and her writing as well. And it's so important to realize that there are more cases out there that do need attention. However, what Jane pointed out on our show, which I you can't help but to agree with, is that the shows are determined by the ratings, and yet we look at ratings as kind of with a negative eye, but the ratings are determined by the public. So the ratings are such that they are. The public is interested in this. We're saying that there's too much coverage. The report today was 69% of the population thinks that there's too much coverage on the story, but yet the ratings are higher through the roof on television than they've ever been before. So, yes, in a way, it feels like we want to blame the media for milking this train, but should we really be looking at ourselves in milking the train?
Yeah, absolutely. Robin Sachs and Wendy Murphy are here. We're going to take a quick break here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio, and my two favorite DAs are here. Even through the break, they talk lawyer stuff on and on and on. It's great. It's fantastic. That's the kind of guests that we want, right, Wendy?
You got it, yep.
And I'm sorry to interrupt your conversation there, but I heard you two talking off air a little bit, and the two great guests that you are and the two great media people that you are, you've already figured out what my next question was going to be, and I was going to talk about the dad, Joe Jackson. Some have accused him of taking advantage of the media already to try and pimp some sort of thing that he is involved in. Nobody likes that term, but it's true. Of course, the history of the Daddy Jackson and the beatings and all that sort of stuff. Let's start with Wendy Murphy, former DA, author, law professor, victims advocate. Let's talk about Joe Jackson and how does he get into all of this?
I hope the answer to that question is not at all. And let's just point out a couple of things. Michael Jackson did not mention him in his will.
Right.
We have heard from more than one source that he was an abusive father, exploited Michael, pushed Michael, beat Michael, which probably has a lot to do with how Michael ended up beating the hell out of himself.
Yeah.
And maybe even explains why Michael tried to turn himself white and grow straight hair and look like anything but his father, including trying to look a bit more female. I mean, I have so little respect for Joe Jackson. And then to the extent people were saying, well, you know, they tried to mend their ways toward the end. Well, I'm not so sure there was some mending going on, given that Joe Jackson, the day after Michael died, was at the BET Awards hawking his new business.
Right.
I mean, there is no end to that man's deplorable, exploitive, grotesque abuse and inhumanity when it comes to his son. So I hope the answer is he has nothing to do henceforth with either the estate or the children. But it's interesting, you know, Debbie Rowe has filed today for custody of her two children, the older two, that she birthed for Michael, Prince and Paris. As we know, a surrogate is, an unknown surrogate is the quote-unquote biological mother of the third child, Blanket. And Debbie Rowe is doing exactly the thing that I find most repulsive in this whole saga of Michael Jackson's life. She's saying, oh, well, of course I have to step up to the plate. And, oh, by the way, I'm getting a restraining order against Joe Jackson. There's no question in my mind, I should say in my opinion, that one of the reasons she's doing that is so she can spin her attempt to exploit yet again this moment in time and suck more money in exchange for giving up whatever little bit of rights she has left. And I hope that the judge ultimately rules that she has no rights left. And I hope the judge considers recommending that she be prosecuted for trying to sell her children. Although it is against the law, she sure as hell keeps trying to sell her children. I just think that the fact she's stepping up to the plate and wants to look like the hero by saying, well, I want a restraining order against Joe Jackson, because, of course, no one in the family is going to condemn Joe at this point. And suddenly that comes out of her as she simultaneously tries to now fight Catherine for custody. All I can think of is this woman will sink to anything. She will stop at nothing. You know, what's that Italian word for balls? Can you even say that on this program? Cajones?
That's
I'm
right.
Italian. I should know this stuff. you know, she's a female with the biggest cojones I've ever seen, going back for custody and then using the fact that Joe Jackson was a known, abusive parent to kind of wedge her way in without the public going, get out of here, Debbie Rowe. Get out of here. You tried to sell your kids like commodities. Go away. Move to an island. You and Joe, move to an island called the Island of Unfit Parents. Both of you, goodbye. That's what I would do. I'd issue that ruling tomorrow if I could.
Yeah, right. Robin, when you hear that, Ed, as a longtime child abuse prosecutor, and you hear that, well, the what happened with the father, the past sort of thing. Is that what Wendy says? Is that legit? Is that Michael Jackson can actually put some of his problems back on his dad who beat the hell out of him? Dad's going to say, yeah, I beat him, but that was tough love in those days. That's how we all were brought up.
Well, first of all, I think that the nice thing, it's the silver lining here, is that we actually have all, and through the benefit of television now, seen in clips and replays of the interviews in which Michael, in his very own words, described the abuse that he suffered. It wasn't a mystery. It wasn't something that was unknown. It's something that was very prominently part of his life and part of many, many interviews. I mean, it was clear he was physically abused, emotionally abused. There was whippings and name-callings and strict disciplinary actions. But more than just that, there was the complete exploitation of Michael Jackson throughout his life. And Joe Jackson was called on that in his own interviews and didn't deny his behaviors. And yes, he justified it by saying that he was a disciplinarian. But there's no dispute that there was abuse in the relationship. And I think that we've always looked at that as, you know, the rationale as to why Michael Jackson became who he was. And I do think that, and I agree with what Wendy has said, is that, you know, of course, this is someone who never grew up and whose life was stunted and didn't even view himself as an adult and therefore could relate to children and probably was attracted to children because that was the way he looked at himself. And those are all the rationale that we look at behaviors. So to have this person who effectively stunted his own son's growth, and not only this one son, but let's not forget all the other children that Joe Jackson father that equally have come forward at different times. I mean, you know, you've heard it from Tito, you've heard it from Jermaine, you've heard it
LaToya.
From LaToya, and you've heard it from Janet. So this isn't like an isolated Michael versus Joe thing. This is a character that this man is, and if he's going to exploit his own child when he's alive at 5 years old, he's not going to stop exploiting when he's dead. And that is the sickest tragedy that would be part of their young Jackson, Michael Jackson kids' lives if this man has any involvement whatsoever.
Wendy, I've been hard on Geraldo lately because I don't like some of the coverage that he's doing that equates Michael Jackson's death to that of Princess Diana. But one of the segments that I did see, and it was an old interview with one of the sisters, LaToya or Janet, I forget which one now.
You mean on Geraldo's old show?
Right, who talked about how wrong it was for her brother to be sleeping with someone else's little children, et cetera, et cetera. How much of that is going to affect everything in this case?
Oh, I don't know. You know, Michael Jackson's dead now. There may have been good reasons to worry about him around children as recently as last week, but he's out of the picture. So I don't know that. I don't know that his past is going to play much of a role. It's possible, I don't want to speculate completely. I would have to actually make something up, but let's assume, pretend for a minute, that the nanny, Grace Waramba, testifies that some untoward things were going on in the home. And let's say she says, you know, Catherine was around and Joe was around and this one was around. In other words, if she can make the claim that the family, in a sense, knew that horrible things were happening in the home, not even necessarily to the children whose custody is at issue, you could arguably see that coming up as relevant to the question, should Catherine be the primary custodial parent? And, you know, even if she is a perfectly wonderful mother, grandmother, should there be conditions imposed on the living arrangements so that the children are not exposed to whatever horrible things were otherwise going on? I'm making this stuff up, but you ask me to what extent might Michael Jackson's predilection to sleeping, oh, God, I hate to even use the euphemism, but, you know, sleeping with little boys might come up. I think it's only likely to come up if it's part of some picture of what was going on in that home that we haven't heard about because it has never come out. And I don't think that Grace Waramba is going to be the person to share that kind of information. She seems awfully loyal. She seems to have been dedicated for something like 20 years so far to Michael Jackson. And thus far, she seems like the only person who hasn't exploited him, who hasn't, you know, sold a story for cash. She seems like the only real mother in the children's lives who has treated them with dignity and respect. There was one report that said the children were crying for her after the Jackson family took the kids to their home when Michael Jackson died. You know, there's an argument that she could go into court and in a sense fight Catherine and Debbie Rowe and ask to be declared the de facto mother of the kids, because there is this very rare but nevertheless valid doctrine in law that says if you have been the primary caretaker for children, even if you're not the biological mother, you're not a relative, but if you've been, in a sense, their only motherly caretaker for a long enough time, the court can recognize you as the de facto parent. I don't think she's likely to do that. It seems the Jacksons are trying to bond with her and perhaps want to include her in some formal sense in a long-term plan to continue to let her raise the children in the way that she's been raising them. But, you know, my point is simply that her role in the family is a really interesting one. She knows where the bodies are buried, so to speak. She's got all kinds of access to information. She's been terribly loyal to Michael and for that reason has lasted for more than 20 years. She reportedly helped pump his stomach on a number of occasions, which is, you know, I love a lot of people, and it would be hard for me to pump their stomach. Let me tell you, that's a disgusting habit to have to take that responsibility on for somebody. God bless her.
But, can I make just one quick comment?
Yes,
just
please,
on this exact area, and actually I was one of the initial people who thought that Grace could have been a potential guardian and someone who potentially would come forward. And what the law in California in terms of estates go is that even whoever is put in a document is a nomination. It's a nomination for who could be or should be, and it reflects what the best wishes of that or the wishes of the person who prepared the will and whose document it is. And so, for example, if Catherine were to be ill or if other people came forward, then they can look at the nomination as one of the factors, and you're absolutely right that Grace could be technically someone who could come forward in that way. And one of the aspects about her, and I don't know if you know this, but she has lupus and is ill. And so I think that is a concern, and also Catherine's age with Grace's medical conditions may leave that opening where Deborah Rowe feels that she can be fit, you know, see fit, or any other people. And I've also heard reports that Diana Ross has been named as a potential backup.
She was named as the substitute in the event Catherine was unable. You know, it's so funny. Give me a woman with lupus any day over a mother like Debbie Rowe who tried to sell her kids like a loaf of bread. That's an easy call. But, you know, but the bottom line remains, this is a very interesting case in the sense that the person who birthed the kids, the person whose egg was used to birth the two older children, is the least desirable mother in the selection of options. And I find that fascinating. I've taught reproductive technologies and rights at MIT and then at my law school where I now teach in a seminar on sexual violence. And this kind of question came up. We've only had these kinds of technologies around for about 20 years. Well, the history of law before you could birth a child and literally not have any connection to it at all, the history was, you know, the mother was the one who birthed the kid and the father was the one who was married to the mother or, you know, whoever had sex. Those were the mother and the father. Now you can literally create children. I mean, you know, blink your eyes and we're going to be birthing kids in large amniotic vats. And then who's the mother? You know, the lab technician? I think it's actually a very interesting and important story from the perspective of children's rights.
Yeah.
Because a very good judge in this case is not going to give Debbie Rowe a thumb on the scale simply because she birthed the children, even though a long history of law would give her the trump card. I think she won't get the trump card here. It'll be Catherine versus the nanny and some combination of, you know, efforts to surround those two with enough legal protection that the risk of exploitation is limited. And I think that would be the right result. But I wish that somebody would just cut Debbie Rowe out of the picture once and for all. I'm afraid she's going to show up year after year and say, well, I found another reason to file for my rights. Oops,
yeah.
Here's another big paycheck. I'll go away now. She did that twice. I mean, keep in mind, she went away with a big fat paycheck when she was divorced after birthing the second child, Paris. She comes back because she saw a nice opportunity after the molestation trial. She thought, oh, here I go. Here's another way to get some money. She filed for custody. She said, I'm concerned about the children's well-being. This is a man who says he sleeps with children. Well, guess what? She took another big fat check and went away. What happened to her concern for the risk of children being molested? Oh, did she just think that was something you could fix with a paycheck? This is the sort of thing the public doesn't understand about the way the law figures out who the good parents are. It used to be you didn't have to prove that you were a good parent. All you had to prove was that you birthed the kid.
Yeah.
So we're actually at a good place. We're doing better by children's rights, that we can finally say Debbie Rowe birthed them, she was married to Michael Jackson, it was her egg, and she should lose.
You know, Robin, we saw I call it a bright light syndrome with Anna Nicole Smith with the crying Judge Seidlin. We haven't got that far here yet, but I believe in the next few weeks, few days, there's going to be some that will come forward to claim paternity of these children, besides whoever is the actual father and mother right now. Where do you think that's going to go? Are we going to see some starstruck judges, lawyers, and some kooks coming out of the woodwork?
Well, actually, Lindsay and I were all about earlier in the week a case where talking about, you know, the right for journalists to come into courtrooms and be able to open up courtrooms to give information to the public so that we can take these and learn, and so that the public has an idea of where the law stands and can see exactly the point that Wendy's making in terms of where we stand now with reproductive rights and who are parents and who, and start evaluating these really difficult questions. You know, yes, there are certainly going to be opportunities for lawyers, for judges, for any host of people to use this as an opportunity to see if they can try out or audition for some sort of reality show later on, should they choose. Or what we can see is something like what we saw in the Specter case, which was Judge Paul Fidler, who was a amazing jurist, who knew the law, who was even-handed, who applied the law appropriately,
didn't cry,
had dignity and respect for both parties, the defendant, the people, the public, and turned it into just the example of what actually goes on without there being a show. So I'm hopeful that the people who are sitting on the bench and the people who are practicing law are not trying out or auditioning for their future careers, but in fact committed to the cause and jobs that they have. But, you know, people go, and then who knows who we're going to get and who we're going to see.
Yeah, anything's possible. We're going to take a break here on Scared Monkeys Radio. I'll give you a chance to go and Google the 1983 New England Patriots and see if you can see Wendy in her cheerleading. No, we'll be right back. We're going to get into and talk about the doctors involved in this case. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio, and we've got Robin Sachs and Wendy Murphy on here. We're talking about Michael Jackson. I want to get into the doctor aspect of this, Wendy. We have the cardiologist that was on scene doing CPR and trying to save his life. We have the dermatologist that has come into the picture now. And if I remember correctly, around 93, 94, he was the guy that was alleged to have taken Jackson down to Mexico to get Jackson's genitals bleached so they wouldn't be identified. So the craziness starts again. If we look at the enablers, Dr. Nicopoulos with Elvis, hundreds of thousands of pills, the doctors that are in trouble right now with Anna Nicole Smith. We have other celebrities, Heath Ledger among them. Now we have this case with Michael Jackson and the doctors. Let's get into the medical part of this and how complicit or how responsible are they, in your opinion?
Well, you know, it's hard to say because we don't know exactly who did what. But I will tell you this. It is damn weird that he had a quote-unquote cardiologist friend living at his house.
Yeah.
And everyone said, well, it was for the tour. He was there to monitor his behavior.
Sure.
The guy gave up his practice to, quote-unquote, take advantage of the opportunity of a lifetime. That doesn't sound like a doctor to me. That sounds like, you know, a sycophant. Mm-hmm. And, I think we have a sense that doctors are professional. They don't do these kinds of crazy things because it's so hard and rigorous to to successfully graduate from law school, even to medical school, and even to get into medical school is so difficult that the people who graduate have to be chock full of integrity and good character. Well, not so much. Mm-hmm. And I think that cases like this teach us that doctors can be scoundrels, they can be criminals, they can be thugs, they can be manipulated and misled and taken advantage of. There are all sorts of things about doctors that we sometimes forget they're human, which means they can be greedy. And this guy, you know, there's so much more to the story when it comes to the drugs that I think we're going to all be shocked by. I hope we're shocked, and I hope we sit up and take notice. The fact is, Michael Jackson dropped dead in his own house with a doctor by his side.
Yeah.
You know, we all probably think about, oh, if we only had a faster access to the hospital, in that case, that person might not have died. Well, there's a doctor literally in the same room with Michael Jackson, and he still died. So the reasons people are raising eyebrows about him are legitimate. What was he doing? What wasn't he doing? This is a cardiologist who, by the way, had never successfully passed his boards to become board certified. I don't know if that means he was a dumb cardiologist or he didn't try that hard, but even a non-cardiologist knows you do CPR on a hard surface, not on a bed, and Michael was on the bed the whole time. Duh, that makes him a stupid doctor, or maybe a complicit doctor. I don't know. What I know that bothers me the most is Michael Jackson's delivered to the hospital. He dies. There are no cops at the house preventing contamination, removal of evidence. So people are coming and going. At one point, there was water gushing out of the garage. What is that about? What were they rinsing?
Yeah.
What was being rinsed out of the garage that we needed to flush it with water the day of Michael Jackson's death or the day after? Why did he take off? Why was he hiring an attorney? Why was that his first feeling? His first feeling was, I should leave town and find a lawyer. Why? What was going on in his mind? Why did Janet show up the next day and take out bags of stuff? Why wasn't there a cop there taking inventory of what was being removed? So what I'm worried about is that there will be a criminal investigation. There are lots of reasons to suspect that untoward things were happening, that some of the people involved were medical professionals, and that the people involved will have very good defenses if there is ever a criminal trial because of, yet again, mishandling of what was clearly a crime scene.
Absolutely. Robin Sachs, your state AG, Jerry Brown, has started, some will say for his own benefit and political advancement, an investigation into the Anna Nicole Smith death and the whole doctor shopping issue, double doctoring, some may call it, the prescription drug thing with celebrities and all of this. How big of an epidemic is it with celebrities and across North America?
I think the scope of this epidemic we have no concept of, because you only find out about it when there's been an overdose. Even when there is and that being an overdose that leads to a death, even when there's been an overdose that doesn't lead to a death, many times it's just classified as the overdose of that particular substance. And the investigation, because there hasn't been a homicide or a death at that point, is not really looked at because there's no mandated reporting process that seems to accompany these medical phenomenon. And I think that, and first of all, I think here living in Los Angeles, I see, you know, the society in which I live and where people are constantly have access to doctors and prescriptions. You see it even in regular folks as well. If you need a note to not go to work, you know which doctor you can call to get that note. You see prescription drug medications being prescribed all the time, and if one doctor won't give it to you, you ask around and find another doctor. I think people do it all the time. It's not just something that happens in the celebrity front, but when the results are that someone dies, it calls everyone to order and has us all want to stand up and do something about it. But I think that there needs to be much, much more regulation that happens much earlier in the medical and drug fields in order to...
Yeah, but you know what, Robin's so right, but you're asking the medical profession to self-police, which
exactly.
would also air their dirty laundry, and they're not going to be up for that. You know what else is interesting, in both in terms of how he found the cardiologist who was there when he died, and how he has connected with others who have apparently provided him with certain medications. Both times the explanation was, oh, one of my security guys had a friend who knew someone who was going to be able to provide me with, you know, blah, 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 fill in the blanks. Both times it's some guy with a friend who knows the right doctor to call. So Robin's absolutely right that there's a dirty, dark underworld of medical professionals. They know who each other is. They're on the same wavelength. They're out there doing very bad things, and it's because the profession doesn't regulate itself that there is this black market of a very, very successful, I might add, black market of doctors making a fortune doing very bad things.
The movies will start, the book deals will start, the you name it will start, and somebody's going to profit from this. How much should the kids be getting from this this whole issue? They are the true heirs. People are going to be making money off their father. I believe there should be a law that in the cases like this, that a percentage should automatically go to the children because they are the benefactors here. Let's start with Wendy.
Hello?
Wendy, you still with me?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear you. You must have blacked out.
I don't know. Yeah, you kind of faded out. I don't know who you were. Which one of us?
There was a bit of a blip. I was listening to the dog and then the little blip.
You're listening to the dog instead of me. Well, that's great.
This is like a multifaceted entertainment show.
Yeah, you bet.
As soon as you hear my children screaming in the background, you know we're all together.
That's okay. You want me to repeat, or did you hear what I said?
Here's what I think. No, I understand your question. Here's what I think. There's a trust, and it was reported that the trust document is quite, voluminous and detailed and specific, and sadly unavailable to us in the public. The only document that has to be filed and made publicly available is the will itself. The will was very short, and it makes reference to the existence of a trust, and it dumps all the stuff into the trust. And therefore, I think we can assume, because it was a pretty, standard will with all the right language. It didn't seem to have anything missing. It correctly, explicitly excluded Debbie Rowe, which has to be done when there's an heir of that level, otherwise presumptively entitled to stuff. You have to say, no, I want to give her nothing. Just like if you wanted to give your assets to two of your children but exclude another one, you have to say so explicitly. And so it seems to have been written in all the correct ways. But the will makes reference to a trust that none of us have seen. And I have no doubt, given the careful language and the highly reputable lawyers involved in preparing the will, that the trust itself absolutely provides for the children to take X percentage of whatever the future royalties might be and all this other stuff. I mean, Michael Jackson is going to continue to make money in his death, as well he should.
Right.
And his children, as the primary heirs, are going to receive all, or at a minimum, the vast majority of that money.
Robin, I'm going to give you the last word, and let's end up with this. 5 years from now, will we still be talking about Michael Jackson and his death? I think Presley's 1977 till today, we're still talking about it, and he's making more money now than he did when he was alive.
I think absolutely. I mean, Michael Jackson has been a legend for a lot of reasons: marred past, interesting family, amazingly talented artist, children from different wives, unusual behaviors, physical changes and transformations, Neverland. I mean, there's so many aspects to Michael Jackson, and if you look at some of the great people who are similar and great legends in terms of music, and then combine that with the great potential injustices in society and great criminals and put them all together in one, we have years and years and years of being able to have different angles. We'll see the 5-year anniversary, the 10-year anniversary. We're going to see the release of this video. We're going to see the books. We'll have many different types of books, and we'll continue to see it and forever, I believe. And given the fact, especially even more so than with Elvis Presley, where here we have the advances of modern technology, where we have the archival of all of this footage and all of the modern technology that allows for this to be replayed into history and easily accessible, and the ability to mix and match and do different takes on the same, essentially the same story, we have many, many more years of this to come.
Absolutely.
And he has three kids, and those three kids are going to create their own news stories and so on and so on.
Yeah. Absolutely.
We'll be talking about it a long time from today. Thank you, ladies. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Dana. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Wendy Murphy and Robin Sachs, two authors, victims, advocates, DAs, you name it, and we wanted to come on and talk about Michael Jackson. That's it. That's tonight's show. Remember our webpage, www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live. You can pick up past shows, daily commentaries, you name it. You can leave comments. And the creme de la creme of blogs, as I like to say, you can find at scaredmonkeys.com. Thank you. We'll see you again real soon here on The Dana Pretzer Show.
You've been listening to The Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.